accession number 28464, reel number 6.
John Harris, reel 6. You were saying, John, about the Battle of the Bulge, the communications had been such that you weren't aware of what was going on. You thought it was strange.
No, quite right. When I got to Liège, as I say, to contact an American division, they said they wanted us to proceed up the valley of the River Orth, which was on the left hand, as one looked at the Germans advancing more or less from the east. It was on the side, on the left side of the bulge, and that had been the Allied effort on that side of the bulge had been handed over to the British, to General Montgomery. And this, I think this particular American regiment that I contacted in Liège was in fact under Montgomery's orders. The Americans weren't very happy about this, but it was probably a good precaution. I think by that time the Americans had more or less, certainly on the other side, on the right-hand side, as we looked at the Germans, they had the matter in hand. They had fought magnificently, for instance, at Bastogne. I think that was the American 101 Airborne. And the Americans really did very, very well in the Ardennes. Now, this one might say was very much in contrast to this situation with American troops who were brought in great numbers across the Atlantic to the landings in the area of Algiers to join us the first army attack, ultimately to get to Tunis and meet the 8th Army, in which we had been for a short time, at Tunis. And the Americans there had a lot of troops who really had very little training. Mm. But by, of course, the Battle of the Bridgehead and their great left hook under General Omar Bradley, and, of course, Patton, Blood and Guts Patton, was now emerging as a very substantial figure, and they had become a serious fighting force. And the British made sure that nothing went wrong, and plans made by the Americans were in fact put into effect, and there was some fierce fighting, but we only had medium serious battles. We reached a village, a town called Marsh, I think, that night. Anyhow, more or less at the head of the River Orth. And things were fairly quiet to begin with. They then hotted up a bit, and the Germans gave... I remember one thing they did. They had managed to capture quite a number of jeeps, which they now manned. That is our jeeps. They had now manned with Germans dressed as Allies soldiers, and they were causing considerable consternation. A jeep with four of them got in my squadron area, but somebody had warned me, and they were chased out. We didn't manage to recapture the jeeps, but it's a very confused fighting. In the middle of this confused fighting, a surprising thing happened. And there are surprises in military affairs, which was an instruction to send one officer and 10 or 12 other ranks on leave to England for a fortnight. I had in my squadron, I think it was 9 officers, And we put nine names in a hat, and I drew one out to send one of them on holiday, and drew my own name out. I then, there was no argument about it, I queried it, I remember, with our regimental commander. No, John, that's an order. Off you go. I handed over to Pat McNaughton, and it took me 3 or 4 days, well, all of us, there were, of course, a lot of people going, this was the strength from one squadron, so it's 3 times that from our regiment, or 4 times that from our regiment, and so there were a lot of people to be transported by bus, I don't think by train. I think it took us four days to ultimately get across the channel from Calais. Fortunately, the leave dated from your arrival in the United Kingdom, and I proceeded to my family home in Staffordshire, on the borders of Staffordshire and Shropshire, between the towns of Wolverhampton and Bridgnorth, where my family had lived since 1920. Now, I had been married to my Swiss fiancée on the 11th of May 1940, she having come from Switzerland on one of the last passenger vessels to cross the channel before the great German attack started. And we'd been married by a special license in Lichfield, and my wife, Erica, was, my late wife now, was at my family home in this little village, as I've said, between Wolverhampton and Bridgnorth. And that's where I spent a lovely fortnight. And then I started the long journey back. It was bitterly cold that winter, and it got worse and worse the nearer I got to the Ardennes. Ultimately, late at night, having travelled out 3 or 4 days again, I landed at my regimental headquarters, where I had my great stroke of luck, still to be here to talk 60 years on. At regimental headquarters, it was supper time. They said, "We'd better have a meal, then we'll send you in an armoured car to your squadron, which is in the line." I don't know that it was actually fighting, but it was holding a line.
Where were the regimental headquarters?
They were in, funnily enough, they were in Marsh, where we had first assembled 3 or 4 weeks before. This was in the third week of January, I should think. Anyhow, we had a good supper, and they got some German brandy, and at about, between 10 and 11 o'clock at night, they said, "Do you really want to go back to your squadron tonight?" I said, "No, I don't." They said, "Well, be sensible. Let's have a word with McNaughton." And Pat said, "Oh, don't be bloody stupid. Stay there." So I did stay there. It then, about midnight, came a question of where I was to sleep. And they said, "You have a choice. We have a big bedroom upstairs, and there are 6 beds, and there's 5 of us occupying them. But it is very, very cold and unpleasant, unattractive. But the alternative is that you stay here. You're in the reasonable warm, but the radio will be on all night with a duty officer by it. And it's his bed that's unoccupied upstairs." So I said, "Well, I've no doubt in mind. I've had a lovely supper and enough brandy to fear the cold. I'll sleep down here, come what may." So I did. And in the middle of the night, I became conscious that somebody was lying on my bed, on me. Got the light on. I think the duty officer must have seen what happened, because the padre, our Church of England padre, covered in blood, was lying on my bed, making a lot of noise. And the Germans had dropped a cluster of small anti-personnel bombs, which by pure chance had landed on the window ledge of this big bedroom upstairs. 2 officers, the adjutant, critical position, and the intelligence officer were killed, and the other 3 were all seriously wounded and evacuated. And that was my stroke of luck. And that really was the end of my regiment, my squadron. I went back to it the next day, And in fact, one of our troops did make a link up with the Americans, which finally sealed, I think. And there is a very widely reproduced photograph of one of my troop leaders, Desmond Owen, who had won a very fine military cross, with his armored cars and their troops, and in the back one German prisoner. Anyhow, it's widely reproduced, and that was the end of the Ardennes battle, as far as we were concerned. So we went back to where we had been in the middle of December, facing the Reichswald, which was between us, the dense German forest, which was between us and the German frontier on the... between us and the Rhine. It was inside the German frontier, of course, but it was between the German frontier and the Rhine itself. And there were weeks of desperate fighting. Names of places like Gnepo and Gok itself. There were, if I ever admired any of our troops, it was the Highland Infantry of that time. We were more or less always unhorsed, fighting as infantry, and of course the Germans were defending their native land, and they defended desperately. Incidentally, against us was the Wehrmacht, the German regular army. Not until the very end of the war did we encounter the dreaded and dreadful SS. The Wehrmacht behaved towards prisoners, for example, in accordance with the Geneva Convention and in accordance with, I hope and believed, we always behaved. Anyhow, but this was very fine, the very best, including the great Panzer divisions, the 15th Panzer and the 21st Panzer, of which I shall have something to say in a very few minutes. We got to the Rhine on the last day of March. The crossing was uneventful. Very brave engineers had managed to get a bridge. They were called a temporary bridge. They were called Bailey bridges, floating bridge. They had got one across. They'd had quite severe casualties, I think, but they did get that across, and the Highland Division got across, as far as my regiment was concerned, I believed, with no casualties.
How wide was it at this point?
The Rhine. I don't know, several hundred yards. I dare say it was a third of a mile across. It's a big river. We actually, for a time, went back into Holland, because I think it sounds odd, but I don't understand it. We did, I remember going, was it before we crossed the Rhine? One is confused, it's no good pretending otherwise, because in a village, in a small town called Bentheim, which is certainly on the frontier, we were, because I remember it was there. I'm sure it's just in Holland. Maybe I've got confused, it was a bit earlier on. But what I remember there was, in the little station, there was an engine with steam up. And before we could say Jack Robinson, one of our troopers, I think, had been an engine driver, and he was in the cab driving up and down in this engine. I remember it also because in the billet where the damaged house in which I stayed out in its garage was a magnificent Mercedes with a silver, and I mean silver, swastika on it. We weren't allowed to loot anything, but we did annex that Mercedes, and it stayed with me until the end of the war, which was only 6 weeks away when this happened. Had to hand it in. Anyway, having crossed the Rhine, we were directed on Bremen and then Bremerhaven, next to Cuxhaven, the famous German base that we were always, naval base that we were always bombing then it must have been 400 or 500 miles, I should think, from where we crossed the Rhine. Of course, and at last, we could behave really as a reconnaissance regiment. Our armoured cars could really perform their original duty. It was in that, the next month, I'm speaking roughly of the month of April, that we were to meet some pockets of SS for the first time, and there was some pretty ferocious but very brief battles with casualties on both sides. But we had our tails up, we at last could see the end in sight, and I think it was on the 4th of May that a troop leader, one of my six troop leaders, by the name of Compton Bishop, I think his Christian name was Terence, but I scarcely knew it because he'd only joined us when we crossed the Rhine or thereabouts as a reinforcement, which of course we, throughout this story from the bridgehead onwards, we were constantly getting reinforcements. Our casualties must have been well over the 300 mark, but I don't have the exact figure. Anyway, he said, usually you communicated on the radio in code, but everything was fluid by this time. And he came up in clear English and said, "Major, I have got a German officer who represents the 15th Panzer Division, and he is authorized by the divisional commander to surrender the 15th Panzer Division to the 51st Island Division." Of course, I said, my immediate reaction to the troop leader was to tell me another, not to believe him, but believe in the end I did. And of course, negotiations were submerged at once into the 51st Highland Division, to the 30 Corps, or whatever it was. And a similar thing was happening within the next 2 days. But I can, with absolute truth, say that the initiation of the surrender of 15 Panzer was to, I think it was 5 troop of B Squadron of the 2nd Derbyshire Yeomanry.
Mm. How many men did that involve in that kind of
division? Give or take 12 to 15,000 divisions. Of course, they may have been out of strength. I don't know, but anyhow, it's in 5 figures. So, really, there ended my war. I'd been, as I've said, I'd been lucky. I had, say, that shouldn't I, won 2 military crosses. Had started as a trooper in the 4th County London Army for a year, and rising to a sergeant. And at the end, our colonel having been demobilised, the second in command moved up, and I became second in command of my regiment. And we were directed to a series of small villages outside Hamburg for the occupation. There immediately became an order that was no fraternization with the Germans. Whoever drafted that order didn't know the British troops, because they had their feet under the kitchen table of German requisitioned houses before you could say Jack Robinson. And we had no trouble. In fact, my squadron was very near a little town called Stade, S-T-A-D-E, and it had a small race course. And the second in command of the Staffordshire Yeomanry, and myself, we got command not of further troops, but of about 80 Russian ponies, which the Germans had captured, the Russians, and we got back from the Germans, and we initiated race meetings until Montgomery heard about it and stopped it. But that went on for a long time. But I'm supposed to be talking about the war.
No, this is interesting, actually, in that it's all part of it. It's all quite important, I think. How the troops occupied themselves, at this moment.
Well, it was the Germans. They were very good. These were German civilians who were only too relieved. I was still on that. Yes. I learned how to run a tote. I won't bore you with that, but you have to be very careful with the people you put in to run a tote, that they don't put a batch of the tickets for a horse that they fancy and then forget to put the money in the kitty. And if you assume the kitty is the number of is the amount of money you've got in the if you assume that the numbers as represented by the last figure representing the number of each sold to each horse, that times that what the basic payment is the kitty, you've got a very unpleasant shock coming. They must have in the tote in England, they must have a great system of searching, intensive searches of everyone who works in the tote. Anyhow, that's nothing. It was really rather boring, of course, the occupation, but the one thing Britain got right in the Second World War was that it was first in, first out. In the First World War, there was terrible trouble. You could almost buy a ticket to demobilisation. There was bad feeling beyond belief. But so I had obviously been in from the very beginning, so I went out before Christmas. As I say, at the end of a lucky war, and I believe the cliche that the Allies saved Western civilization. I personally believe that is true. I'm proud of my country's contribution, and of course the wonderful help we had from the Americans and from the Russians. But my final words be these: let it never be forgotten, but for those brave airmen of the RAF and of course Czech and other pilots alongside them, let it never be forgotten, but for their victory in the Battle of Britain, there would have been no chance for the rest of the war to have proceeded at last to its successful conclusion, because Britain would have been occupied. May it never happen again. Thank you.
Thank you. John, could you just tell me a little bit about you had two military crosses, I believe.
Yes, I did, yes.
Yes,
I've got a civilian OBE too, but I've got military, but
should we just stop here and you watch your for the medals, so there's two crosses here, I see.
That actually is an officer of the Order of the British Empire.
Right.
That is one military cross, and that's the other. That's called a bar.
Oh, right. And what? Could you tell me how you got this?
Well, that is one of the two military crosses, and I got that for the defence of Escobar in 1944.
Right.
And I got that for the performance of my squadron. All the ribbons anyone ever got is due to the wonderful troops they commanded, and I had a very fine squadron trained by my predecessors. And then you have it's called the 1939-45 star. Mm-hmm. That is having been in throughout the thing. That is, we're very proud of that. That is the Africa Star, with an eighth army clasp on it. That is the France and Germany. That is for the European, taking part in the European invasion, and in our case for squadron going from the bridgehead to Bremerhaven.
The France and Germany Star.
Yes, that's right. Well, now we're getting down a bit. This is the defence medal that everyone who took part in the war is entitled to. And lastly, this is another medal for 1939 to 1945. Last of all, what I'm rather proud of is an extraordinary. This is a medal to recognise the fact that you were territory before the war. If you were an officer, you've got a territorial decoration. But if you were another rank, which I was. Entirely in my pre-war service, I was a trooper throughout 1939. You can put EM after your name. For some reason, it has the most ridiculous title. It's called the Efficiency Medal, but I don't remember there being any exam. I don't think there was. Anyhow, what it does do, it just marks the fact that you're in the territorial army. You're not still recording, are you?
Yes.
Oh. Anyhow, there we are.
Well, it was most interesting. Thank you very much indeed. It was really.
I'm sure I've forgotten something, but more or less.
Yeah, well, there's so much there. Thank you very much.
I'm sure you won't. Somebody will cut that to.